Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Phil Dierking. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Turkey's president has called on the country's defense allies to take a stance against an American plan for a Kurdish-led border security force in Syria. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, should oppose such a force. The United States and its partners want to establish the security force to control the border area between Syria, Iraq, and Turkey. The move is part of the United States-led effort against the Islamic State group, often called IS. Syrian Kurdish militia are to lead the new security force, which is expected to reach 30,000 members in the next few years. However, Turkey has been threatening to launch a military offensive in Syria against Kurdish militia there. Turkey considers them to be terrorists because of their ties to outlawed Kurdish rebels fighting Turkey. Erdogan addressed members of his ruling party on Tuesday. During his speech, he said, "Hey NATO, you are obliged to make a stance against those who harass and violate the borders of your members." Both Turkey and the U.S. are NATO members. NATO called Turkey a highly valued ally and said the alliance was committed to Turkey's defense. However, it said that the matter was an issue for the anti-IS coalition led by the U.S. Ties between Turkey and the United States have worsened over U.S. support of the Kurdish militia. Turkey says the Kurdish People's Defense Units, or YPG, is a major threat to its security. But the U.S. has relied on Kurdish militia with ties to the YPG to defeat the Islamic State terror group. Russia, a major force in the area, opposed the U.S. plan for a border security force. It said the force could lead to the splitting up of Syria. The Syrian government called the U.S. plan an attack on Syrian sovereignty. It promised to win back control of the whole country and remove any form of U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish force.
Car manufacturers are wasting no time preparing for the day when Saudi Arabian women will be permitted to drive. The first car show just for women was recently held at a shopping center in the western coastal city of Jeddah. The event came a few months after Saudi Arabia's King Salman ordered an end to a long-time ban on women drivers. An announcement in September said the order to give women legal permission to drive would be carried out by June 2018. Pink, orange, and yellow balloons were placed in the showroom to welcome the women. Attendees were seen looking at different kinds of vehicles. Many sat inside the cars, and some even posed for photos and selfies in front of their favorite models. One possible customer, Ghada Al-Ali, said the car show was a big deal because it was the first such event to be held in the kingdom. "I've always been interested in cars, but we didn't have the ability to drive," she said. "Now, I'm very interested in buying a car." Sharifa Mohammed supervised saleswomen at the event. She said the place where the show was held made perfect sense. "This whole mall is run by women anyway. All the cashiers are women. Everyone in the restaurants are women." Saudi Arabia's decision to end the ban on women drivers is part of a larger effort by the country's 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He has proposed many economic and social reforms. Some reforms have faced opposition from conservative clergymen with large followings. I'm Brian Lynn.
On a recent program, we told you the stories of some English words borrowed from Japanese. Today, we will tell you about words English has taken from languages of the Americas. The Americas include North America, South America, and the Caribbean. When Europeans arrived in the land now known as North America, millions of indigenous people were already living there. Indigenous Americans are often called Native Americans and sometimes American Indians. Archaeologists say that indigenous people had inhabited North America for some 30,000 years before European settlers arrived. Eventually, the settlers would forcibly remove many of them from their land. Others died of European diseases. Native Americans lost nearly all of this land during the American conquest. Today, they make up less than 2% of the U.S. population. And yet, English has kept a large number of indigenous words, including the names of places, animals, plants, and foods. Most of the words that English has borrowed come from the Algonquin group of languages. The word Algonquin also refers to the group of tribes that speak those languages. Algonquin languages were spoken, and some are still spoken, along North America's Atlantic coast, from Canada to South Carolina and west to the Great Plains. Let's start with U.S. place names.
It is not very well known, even by Americans, that 26 U.S. states are named after Native American tribes or their lands. That is more than half of the states. For example, Alabama is named for the Alibamu tribe, and Kansas is named for the Kansa or Ka tribe. The word Kansa is believed to mean people of the south wind, though that is probably not its original meaning. Many of our town, river, and lake names are also Native American in origin. For example, two of the Great Lakes, Erie and Michigan, are Algonquin words. The word Michigan comes from the word Michigama, meaning large lake. Michigan is also the name of the state next to this lake. And Erie comes from the Erie Honon people. Gary McCone is the head of Library and Information Services for the American Indian Higher Education Consortium. He told VOA that the reason so many Native American place names were used is likely because early European explorers needed a way to communicate with local Native people. Changing place names would have made that more difficult. The names of dozens of common American animals are also from Algonquin languages. They include chipmunk, moose, caribou, opossum, raccoon, and skunk. In addition to Algonquin languages, English has borrowed words from the Nahuatl language of Central America and the Arawak languages of the Caribbean and South America.
For example, the name of another animal common to America, the coyote, comes from Nahuatl. A coyote is a small, dog-like animal with large ears. The original Nahuatl word was coyotl. The word first passed through the Spanish language before becoming part of English. Here's another example from Nahuatl, chocolate. Spaniards also first borrowed this word before it reached English. The Nahuatl word for chocolate is chocolatl. Mesoamericans grew and consumed cacao for centuries before Europeans came into contact with it. The word chocolatl was originally the name for an ancient, fermented, Mesoamerican drink made from ground cacao seeds. Then, in the early 1500s, Spanish conquistadors observed how native people valued cacao beans. They took them back with them to Spain. The Arawak languages of the Caribbean and South America, such as the Taino language, have also given the English language many words. Two of them are hammock and barbecue. In English, the word hammock is a kind of hanging bed made from cloth. The cloth is hung between two poles or trees. It comes from the Taino word hamaca, of the indigenous people of the island of Hispaniola. It once meant stretch of cloth. Hammock is another example of a word that passed through Spanish first before reaching English. Native people of Central and South America first developed and used hammocks. Years later, sailors used them on boats to sleep more comfortably and make good use of a small space. Explorers and soldiers also used them in forested areas. Today, hammocks are very popular among Americans.
Another word of Taino origin is barbecue. The English meaning refers to a method of cooking over an open fire using wood or charcoal and a grill. Barbecue is also the word for the cooking device used in this cooking method. The indigenous word was barabiku and meant structure of sticks set upon posts. It referred to the raised wooden structures that indigenous Caribbeans used to cure meat on or to sleep on. Other language research says it meant sacred pit. After Christopher Columbus reached America in 1492, Spaniards came across indigenous Taino people roasting meat barbecue style. In 1526, a Spanish explorer was the first person to use the word in Spain when he wrote of barbacoa in a Spanish dictionary. Back in the Americas, as Spanish conquistadors began to travel north, into what are now the southern United States, they brought along the barbecue cooking method. Today, most Americans use at least one Native American word each day as they talk about places, foods, animals, and other things. Join us again soon to learn the history of English words borrowed from other languages. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. On March 4, 1829, Andrew Jackson was sworn in as president. The sky over Washington was cloudy that day, but the clouds parted and the sun shone through as Jackson began the ride to the Capitol building. Thousands of cheering supporters saw this change in weather as a good sign. So many people crowded around the Capitol that Jackson had to climb a wall and enter from the back. He walked through the building and onto the open area at the front where the ceremony would be held. The ceremony itself was simple. Jackson made a speech that few in the crowd were able to hear. Then Chief Justice John Marshall swore in the new president. In the crowd was a newspaper man from Kentucky, Amos Kendall. "It is a proud day for the people," Kendall wrote. "General Jackson is their own president." From the Capitol, Jackson rode down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Behind him followed all those who had watched him become the nation's seventh president. The crowds followed him all the way into the White House, where food and drink had been put out for a party. Everyone tried to get in at once. Clothing was torn. Glasses and dishes were broken. Chairs and tables were damaged. Never had there been a party like this at the president's mansion. Jackson stayed for a while, but the crush of people tired him, and he was able to leave. He spent the rest of the day at his hotel room in Virginia. The guests at the White House finally left after drinks were put on the table outside the building. Many of the people left through windows because the doorways were so crowded. Jackson was popular with many voters who saw him as representing the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his own vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Calhoun wanted to become the next president, but Jackson preferred his Secretary of State, Martin Van Buren. The split between Jackson and Calhoun deepened over another issue. Jackson learned that Calhoun had once called for Jackson's arrest. Calhoun wanted to punish Jackson for his unauthorized military campaign into Spanish Florida in 1818. The most important division between the two men was Calhoun's belief about who had more power, the states or the federal government. Calhoun came to believe the rights of the states were stronger than the rights of the federal government. His feelings became well known during a debate on a congressional bill. The year before Jackson took office, Congress passed a bill to require taxes on imports. The purpose of the taxes was to protect American industries. The state of South Carolina, Calhoun's state, opposed the measure. South Carolina, like other southern states, had almost no industry. It was an agricultural area. Import taxes would only raise the price of products the South imported. South Carolina refused to pay the tax. Calhoun wrote a long statement defending South Carolina's action. In the statement, he developed what was called the Doctrine of Nullification. The doctrine declared that the power of the federal government was not supreme. Calhoun argued that, instead, supreme power belonged to the states. He said states did not surrender this power when they approved the Constitution. In any dispute between the states and the federal government, he said, the states should decide what is right. Calhoun argued that if the federal government passed a law that any state thought was not constitutional or against its interests, that state could temporarily suspend the law. The other states of the Union, Calhoun said, would then be asked to decide the question of the law's constitutionality. If two-thirds of the states approved the law, the complaining state would have to accept it or leave the Union. If less than two-thirds of the states approved it, then the law would be rejected. None of the states would have to obey it. It would be nullified, canceled. Senators Robert Hayne of South Carolina and Daniel Webster of Massachusetts debated the question of nullification in Congress. Senator Hayne spoke first. He said that there was no greater evil than giving more power to the federal government. The major point of his speech could be put into a few words: liberty first, union afterwards. Senator Webster said Hayne had spoken foolishly. Liberty and union could not be separated, Webster said. It was liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. No one really knew how President Andrew Jackson felt about nullification. He made no public statement during the debate. Leaders in South Carolina developed a plan to get the president's support. They decided to hold a big dinner honoring the memory of Thomas Jefferson. Jackson agreed to attend the dinner. The speeches were carefully planned. They began by praising the democratic ideas of Jefferson. Next, they discussed South Carolina's opposition to the import tax. Finally, the speeches were finished. It was time for toasts. President Jackson made the first one. He stood up, raised his glass, and looked straight at Vice President John C. Calhoun. He waited for the cheering to stop. "Our union," he said, "it must be preserved." Calhoun rose with the others to drink the toast. He had not expected Jackson's opposition to nullification. His hand shook, and he spilled some of the wine from his glass. Calhoun was called on to make the next toast. "The union," he said, "next to our liberty, most dear." He waited a moment, then continued, "May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and by giving equally the benefits and burdens of the Union." President Jackson left a few minutes later. Most of those at the dinner left with him. The nation now knew how the president felt, and the people were with him, opposed to nullification. But the idea was not dead among some people in South Carolina. The nullifiers held a majority of seats in the state's legislature at that time. They called a special convention. Within 5 days, convention delegates approved a declaration of nullification. They said citizens of South Carolina need not pay the federal import taxes. The nullifiers also declared that if the federal government tried to use force against South Carolina, then the state would withdraw from the Union and form its own independent government.
This cut very deeply with Jackson. Jackson was a nationalist. He was a great believer in the federal union. He was a flag-waving patriot. And as Jackson saw it, nullification was the beginning of the end of the United States as a nation.
That was historian Daniel Feller. He says Jackson believed in a limited federal government. But that did not mean the people of every state should decide what the Constitution means.
That way lies chaos, as Jackson said. Either we have a national government or we don't. And if Congress does pass laws which might prove to be unconstitutional, we have a procedure for dealing with that. We have the Supreme Court. We have the ability of the people and their elected representatives to appeal to Congress to repeal those laws, to take them back. But you can't have every state going off on its own and deciding what the Constitution says.
Jackson wrote a proclamation answering the nullifiers. In it, he said, America's Constitution formed a government, not just an association or group of sovereign states. South Carolina had no right to cancel a federal law or to withdraw from the Union. Jackson explained that it was his duty as president to enforce the laws of the land. Even as Daniel Feller says, if he had to use force.
It's going to come to a test of arms, and then, and this I can quote, and it was in italics, underlined, emphasized in the printed version of the proclamation. Disunion by armed force is treason. Are you really ready to incur its guilt?
Jackson sent 8 warships to the port of Charleston, South Carolina, and soldiers to federal military bases in the state. While preparing to use force, Jackson offered hope for a peaceful settlement. In a message to Congress, he spoke of reducing the federal import tax that hurt the sale of Southern cotton overseas. He said the tax could be reduced because the national debt would soon be paid. Congress passed a compromise bill to end the import tax by 1842. South Carolina's congressman accepted the compromise, and the state's legislature called another convention. This time, the delegates voted to end the Nullification Act they had approved earlier. They did not, however, give up their belief in the idea of nullification. Daniel Feller says one reason is because Southern politicians thought they might need to use nullification later. An anti-slavery movement was beginning to grow in the country. Some Southerners worried that Congress would one day make laws they did not like against slavery. The issues of slavery and states' rights would continue to be areas of conflict. Eventually, they would help start the Civil War in 1861. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.